From the BBC World Service, welcome to the latest edition of the Documentary Podcast. Every week we bring you a range of stories from our presenters and reporters across the world. Please do rate the documentary on your podcast app and leave a comment. Let us know what you think.
The day of the election in November 2005, how did it feel?
It's like after a long climb up a mountain, you can stand on top and you look around and you see the hills, the valleys, and all the things that represent the experiences of that long road. And you feel the wind coming to you at the top of the mountain. It's like you can fly.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, describing the day she became president of Liberia in 2006, and even more, Africa's first elected female head of state. I'm Lise Doucette, and this is the final episode of Her Story Made History, the BBC World Service series exploring how women made history in their own countries. I've travelled to Liberia to see the woman they call Ma Ellen. Her long road to the top of that mountain began 67 years earlier, 1938, in her country's capital, Monrovia. And from the very beginning, a wise old man predicted greatness.
I was lying on my mother's bed, you know, a few days old. And as I was told the story by her and others, an old man came, in keeping with the tradition, he came to see the new baby. And he looked down on the bed where I was lying, and he said to my mother, Martha, the name of my mother, this child would be great. Of course, as we went through my early childhood and then on to that, greatness did not come very well. And people would then say, oh, you know, old man prophecy. There's nothing to that. And then I too, as I became more educated and my perspective on things broadened, I too begin to question this old man's prediction, because, you know, the scientific aspect of my knowledge said, you know, people just can't predict the future.
What was it like growing up in Liberia then? Such a different place from Liberia now. Both your grandmothers were illiterate. Your grandfather was a tribal chief. He had eight wives, and there were no roads in Liberia outside of the capital. Tell me what Liberia was like for you growing up.
You know, I grew up with a loving family. I grew up with a Christian family. They always told me that I was a quiet one. I sat on the steps, you know, all by myself and thought. But I also was a tomboy because I played ball with the young boys. I climbed trees. We had a coconut tree and other trees in my yard. I would go to pick fruit, to throw stones at fruit. So it was that part of me. And the other part was that I was very quiet, always contemplating. As a child, not contemplating much about what I would do next, what game I would play next, perhaps. We were a religious family. My mother was a teacher and a preacher. And so we spent most of our time going to school, doing house chores, making sure we said prayers every morning. It was happy for me and my siblings as we grew up. The one good thing also, my father never let us forget our roots. So we lived in town. In those days, we were considered part of the elite because my father was the first indigenous person in the legislature.
In Liberia, indigenous means families who've always lived there, not the people they call settlers, the African Americans freed from slavery in the United States who sailed to the West African coast in the 19th century and founded the Republic of Liberia. A division remains to this day.
I always tell people that perhaps one of the motivations for my wanting to be president is that I crossed both worlds. I came from the world of the elites because my father was in a place where he played a leadership role in the country. And so he had the comforts of life like anyone else in that class. But at the same time, like I say, he didn't forget his roots. Because we lived in the city, went to school in the city, but as soon as school closed, he made us go back to the countryside, go back to the village, where my grandmother, illiterate, never had come to the city. We went back there where she made her farm. She lived in a hut. And we went there, and for the period of our vacation, 2 months, 3 months, we stayed in the farm.
All doors seemed to be opening for Ellen's ambitious father in his new world of power and privilege. But then, suddenly, they slammed shut. In his mid-40s, he suffered a stroke. It left him paralyzed, confined to his home. It forced Ellen's mother to sell baked goods to help make ends meet. And it forced Ellen to make some choices.
I got married after high school, a few months after high school, 17 years old.
So much so they said they called your wedding the Tom Thumb wedding because the two of you were so young.
That's right, because my brother, you know, walked me into the church because my father could not. And yeah, and so we're both quite young. He was 15 years old. And my life started much too early.
So by the age of 22, you had 4 sons under the age of 5, 22 years old.
That's right. And it's one of those things that that is hard to explain, because if I say to somebody I had 2 children in 1 year, they say that's impossible. But it's not, because my second son was born December 31st, just before the year ended. But yes, I had successively my children very fast, 4 children. Their father, my husband, was someone who had returned from college in the United States. And he was just starting a professional life. I was bogged down with 4 children. And so, you know, we too didn't have that much. And so I went to work also. In between the time of taking care of the home and the children, I too got jobs to do things, to make do so we could be able to take good care of children and to send them to school.
The young mother found work doing bookkeeping in an auto repair shop while some of her close friends left Liberia to pursue their studies, their dreams. Ellen admits that when they came home and saw her, they felt sad for her. But for Ellen, this was a time when she found herself becoming stronger. And when her husband got a scholarship to do his PhD in the United States, she went with him to do a business degree.
Tell me a bit about your husband, James Sirleaf. You fell in love with him. He was a dashing, tall, dashing figure with a military bearing.
Yes, yes, that's all true. He was handsome. He was suave. And so, yes, I was in love with him, and we had 4 children. I suppose the difficulty came when I began to progress, you know, in my profession and begin to step aside from the things he was accustomed to me doing. So that I could be able to spend more time learning. And that ultimately led to problem.
And when did your husband start becoming violent with you, hitting you?
Well, that happened in a way throughout, particularly in those years when we both came back and I was, like I say, progressing in my career. And I spent a lot of time, instead of going to bed in the night, you know, which was customary, I spent time at the table with the adding machine, you know, trying to prepare myself for the next day's work.
The teenage mother was now a woman with a business degree from an American university, rising through the ranks in Liberia's Ministry of Finance.
He was jealous of your professional advancement? And was that just him, or was that the society?
No, I think it was he. I think he was by nature a jealous person. And my spending so much time away from him led to problems. And that's when the fouling started. I mean, first of all, you know, in the school he went to, Tuskegee Institute, he excelled in ROTC, that is Reserve Officers Training Corps, where they're taught to be soldiers, you know. And so he came back. He had a militant nature, and this is why he had guns. I mean, I recall one incident when we were away in school where I was, you know, taking a bath. He just hit, and I got struck with a gun. I mean,
he just went up to you in the bath and just took the butt of a gun and hit you.
I don't recall. I guess annoyed because, again, I was working at different places. I worked at the drugstore, and then I worked at a muffler company. And so, again, maybe coming back home late, that was his reaction to it.
Were you scared a lot of the time?
Yes, I was scared. I had to be scared. But I think I got accustomed to him at that stage. And even though he would be violent and he would do things like that, he never went the full step of actually hurting me to a place where I had to seek medical help or something like that.
And then came a defining moment. Her husband, drunk and furious, pointed a gun at her again as she entered their home. Their son, 8 years old, rushed forward, pointing a can of mosquito repellent, shouting, "Stop!" His father put the gun down. Ellen realized she had to end her marriage, even though it meant her four sons would no longer live with her. In her memoir, she writes of a mother's intense pain.
Now, through these circumstances, able to really focus on your dreams, your ambitions for education and advancement, and you started what I have to say has been a series of speeches throughout your life where you spoke your mind and got into trouble. Tell me what happened in 1969 when you were at a Harvard conference and you gave a very blunt speech.
Well, I think that's where that started the road to the presidency, really. I give a speech in which I question the status quo, pointed to all the systemic faults and policy shortcomings that existed, and called for radical change in many of the things we did. That led me into trouble because, you know, a cabinet meeting was called where it was discussed, you know, whether I should be jailed, how should I be punished.
Because you used a word that a lot of people had not heard of before.
Yeah.
Kleptocracy.
Kleptocracy, that's right. I recall that one way back there, and I said that. I had been reading a lot, and then that came to me, the kleptocracy, and I put that in the speech.
Which means taking of the money.
Excessive corruption, you know.
He told you then, you better, Dr. Papanek said, you better leave.
You're going to really get into trouble here, you know, because the government then was not tolerant of criticism and free speech. But eventually they did have a cabinet meeting. They did discuss penalty. They decided not to proceed with the penalty. Dr. Papanek had arranged for me to take the GRE, you know, to prepare myself for going, which I went through that process. And then, got the scholarship and left the country.
And by 1979, one of your many first female finance minister of Liberia. How did that feel?
I was ready for it at that time because I had worked through the ranks.
And what she had written about, warned about while studying at Harvard was becoming a reality. A growing divide between indigenous Liberians and the Americo-Liberian elite. In 1980, a group of young soldiers, led by 28-year-old Sergeant Samuel Doe, seized power. They shot the president dead in his bed. All his government ministers were called in for questioning, including the finance minister, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. The young, uneducated soldier needed her advice on how to run the country.
We used to go in. Sit in this hut and get asked questions. And then one day, Sergeant Doe told me, "Okay, you can come with me for a ride." And I didn't know where we're going. And then he drove into the army camp. And he had all these people lined up, some of them shirtless. And as I looked at them, many people in those lines were people I had worked with. Many of those people, including my brother, who was standing there, I mean, I think that was the most hurtful moment because you look at those people and they look in your eyes and you, what can you say? I mean, you're pained, but you're also afraid.
So they saw you as a traitor in some way?
Well, I'm sure as they saw me, I'm sure they had to think that. It was a terrible time for the country. Terrible time for us, certainly for me.
And the worst moment was yet to come. 10 days after the coup, 13 members of the cabinet were lined up on the beach, stripped to the waist, and shot dead. Only 4 ministers were spared, including Ellen. But it was only a matter of time before she realized this wasn't a government she could work with. Yet again, she returned to the United States, to her other world of senior positions in the World Bank and then Citibank. But the tug of her homeland pulled her back. I first met her then in the early 1980s, when she returned to Liberia to help establish a new political party. But yet again, the blunt banker got into trouble with a speech. This time, the word which caused upset was idiots. That's what she called Liberia's new leaders. It got her arrested.
I ended up in jail, charged with sedition. Had to go to a military court. And I was declared guilty by the military court, sentenced to 10 years at hard labor.
In your book, you describe that this was the beginning of what you described as your special relationship with the women of Liberia, because they circulated a petition for you, calling for you to be released.
My friend Clav and her mother were very instrumental in this. They organized a women group, and they all signed this petition, 20,000 or so of them that signed this petition asking for my release. That surely made some difference also. No matter how hard General Doe may have been, I think the action by the women must have touched also touched something in him.
Ellen was free, but not for long. A few months later, on November 13th, there was a failed coup attempt and a ruthless response. Many were thrown into jail, including Ellen. She would later call it the worst night of her life.
During the night, you know, people would come and taunt you and yell at you and abuse you. And there was an attempt at sexual violence, but that didn't happen because somebody who came from my father's area, my father's tribe, came and he stopped that.
Sexual violence against you?
There was an attempt. When a soldier came and said, you know, I'm going to open this door and I'm going to. But as he tried to open the door, this other soldier came in and said, you know, as you were, in keeping with the soldier dictates. And then, of course, he asked me something that you say you're from. You know, where my father's tribe, from my ancestral village. You say you're from there? I said, yes. He said, can you speak the dialect? Well, fortunately, I knew a little bit of it. So I said a few things and said where the village was. Then he said, okay, nobody will bother you. I'm going to stay here tonight to make sure that you are not bothered. And so that's how I got saved from that.
So many brutal, bloody years, but the worst was yet to come. In 1989 began the Civil War, what they call here the Dark Days, 14 years of brutal chaos. What was it like when it began?
Well, after my prison sentence, I left the country. So I, too, was reading about most of what was happening, but I was not here. And so I embarked on trying to get to countries, to the leaders of countries, to talk about the evils that were going on. I was part of an association based in the United States that was fighting to bring to the world's consciousness what was going on in the country. At that time, I was doing work as a consultant with a bank, traveling before, writing letters, trying to convince people that things were not going well in the country. And they were not.
Liberia was utterly shattered. 2 decades of unspeakable savagery, brutal dictatorship, and an orgy of depravity and violence. the young coup leader turned president, Samuel Doe, was tortured to death. The rebel leader turned president who ousted him, Charles Taylor, was later sentenced to 50 years in prison for war crimes. Like many others, Ellen had initially supported the charismatic Charles Taylor and then realized what kind of person he really was. When peace finally came, it was time to elect a new president. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf believed her moment had come.
Elections. No one expected Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, 67-year-old grandmother, could win. But you thought, I'm going for it. Why?
Once again, I felt I had the courage. At this stage, I felt I had already earned my stripes, and the last thing to do was to go for this one. And the women stood with me again, And the women, too, felt a woman's time had come, that this country had been ruled by men for all these 180-something years. And now it was time for us to make a bid for it.
It was an extraordinary story that if you were a woman, you could go to the head of the queue to vote. So they got women to pretend they were pregnant. They had one baby that they kept passing to all the women. Nobody noticed the same baby was being brought to the head of the queue to vote.
Well, I think just as an example of women's determination and women's ability under circumstances to be innovative. So that, and it worked.
How important was it to you that you hadn't just become the president of Liberia, that was big in itself, but you were the first elected female president in Africa?
It went beyond the women of Africa to women of the world in faraway places where they too have not had the opportunity for the equity they rightfully deserve. They too were there, and their voices were also heard. Women of Liberia heard them and followed their lead, and they provided what has become that first big step, that crack in the glass ceiling.
Madame President, that's what they call her. I saw how Liberian women came out wherever she went to thank her, and she thanked them again.
The women gotta be there. Yeah. And so we'll go there and a woman stand up and all she would say is, Madam President, thank you for giving us a voice. Yeah. And I saw...
After 12 years in power, she was handing over to George Weah, the former soccer star that she beat in 2005, who won last year's election.
Today we were with the women. Women from rural areas who came to thank you. They danced, they sang, they praised you. You were smiling. What went through your mind when you saw these women coming to you like this after your two terms in office?
I just thought about how the women reacted, who they were, what their faces looked like in 2005 and 2006. When really, they had been through so much because of the conflict, two decades of conflict. They had lost so much. And at that time, they just needed somebody to give them hope, somebody to assure them that life could return to normal for them. Today, I reflected upon that and saw the dancing, the smiles on their face, the cheering, and I just felt so good. We've come a long way. These women now know that they belong, that they can claim the future, they can claim ownership, they can claim participation in everything that we do. So it's such a nice feeling to see the women so happy.
But for all the celebration and genuine pride, Liberian women, including Ellen, know there's still a long way to go. Liberia is now at peace, but it's still a land of wrenching poverty and widespread illiteracy. One of the first things the first woman leader did was to criminalize rape. But as she leaves, some male politicians are already trying to change the law. Tackling corruption was her number one priority, she said. Her critics say she didn't do enough.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, you're 79 now. You're a woman who hasn't stood still. What's next?
I just want to be able to leave behind symbols, examples, record of my journey so that young girls and women can be able to read about it, can be able to see it, can be able to use it as an example as they move ahead in their lives toward the achievement of their political goals or their professional goals.
Madam President, it's really lovely to speak with you again.
Thank you, Liz.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, a woman I first met when she was just entering politics and then met again as she was ending her time in power. And she brings an end to our series. If one thing is clear from all five of our conversations, it's that women who lead face unique pressures because they are women, no matter the culture or country. In the last century, women have come a long way. In some ways, though, we're still fighting the same battles, but with the kind of courage and conviction which means women will keep making history.
Thanks for listening. We'll have more for you soon, and please do subscribe. The documentary is just one of our BBC World Service podcasts. There are many others to choose from. Why not try Global News?
Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, whatever the time of day, there is one place to go if you want to know what's going on in the world: the Global News podcast. I'm Jackie Leonard, and I'm one of the presenters. The great thing is, we make new editions of our podcast 7 days a week, bringing you unrivaled reporting and analysis from our correspondents around the world. You may be one of the many who listen already. Hello. And if you're not, do join us and see what you've been missing. Search for Global News wherever you get your podcasts. That's Global News from the BBC World Service.